morning and welcome to Fiber Hooligan. I'm your host, Benjamin Levesay, and for the next hour or so, I'd like to invite you to grab your cup of coffee, tea, or Diet Dr. Pepper, if that's your beverage of choice, and settle in for the 65th episode of Fiber Hooligan. For those of you who are wondering who the heck I am the CEO of XRX Inc., home of Knitters Magazine, XRX Books, and Stitches Expos. If you are tuning in for the first time, Fiber Hooligan is a podcast hosted by yours truly and dedicated to bringing you interviews with the best of the fiber arts world, including experts and designers in the crafts of knitting, crochet, spinning, weaving, as well as anything else that I think is interesting. I want to make sure that I thank the good folks over at Prime Publishing. Prime Publishing is the exclusive media sponsor for Fiber Hooligan, and this show is brought to you by AllFreeKnitting.com, your source for great knitting patterns. If you haven't checked them out yet, please head on over to allfreeknitting.com to get in on the fun. I want to welcome the new listeners today. Thank you for tuning in and trying out the show. I hope you enjoy it. I can't wait for us to get to know each other better. And of course, I'd like to welcome back our regular Fiber Hooligan listeners. Your ongoing support means so very much to me. We do have another sponsor for today's show. Today's show is also brought to you by Stitches Expos. Yes, our own company. And the reason that we're doing this is we would like to thank the good folks over at Webbs, America's Yarn Store, for over two decades of partnership at Stitches, and to congratulate them on 40 years of business, great customer service, and excellence in the fiber arts industry. Okay, let's get to the show today. My guests today are the founders of Webbs, America's Yarn Store. We've had Steve Elkins, their son, and his wife Kathy Elkins on the show before to talk about Webbs. But this is going to be a fun, almost prequel to that show. These two guests are going to share with us the history and the evolution of Webbs, from a basement business to the industry leader that it has become over the last 40 years. And for those of you who may have missed it, this is the 40th anniversary of Webbs. These are two remarkable business people who I remember meeting for the first time when I was a teenager, and yet I think that we might have met before that. I'm so pleased to have them on the show so you can hear how they defined and innovated their business model in the fiber arts world. I'm speaking, of course, of Art and Barbara Elkins. Art and Barbara join us this morning from Amherst, Massachusetts. Good morning, Art and Barbara, and welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you.
It's so great to have you on. This is a real treat. I don't know if you both remember me when I was littler running around the show.
I remember you probably before you were you.
Probably.
Not quite. But I think that I remember you from ads in either Prairie Wool Companion or Early Weavers.
That's right, I did. I think I did show up in a Brown Sheep ad once upon a time because they asked us to do something. I think I remember that. Oh, boy, yes, it's been a long time.
Long time, yeah.
It really is. It's really wonderful. I mean, of course, I see you, Art, every so often at the show, which is great. Barbara, I saw you, I think it was 2 years ago when I visited Webbs. You were weaving in the weaving room, which was wonderful to see you again, too. This is kind of historic, and I do appreciate you being on. This is a great story, folks, and I know you're going to want to hear it. And the great thing about this is that Art and Barbara can speak, and I don't have to like prompt them along. They've told this story a number of times. But one of the big things that we want to talk about with the founders of Webbs today, of course, that this is your 40th year anniversary, and that's a very, very big deal.
Sure is. It's been a long time, and Kathy and Steve are just doing a fantastic job with that business right now. So, and it's growing phenomenally and successfully, and comes a long way from where we started in the cellar of our house.
Well, that's a nice segue. Thank you for that segue, Art. I really appreciate that. So let's throw it back over to you, Barbara, because the story of how it got started and why it got started, I think the story of why it got started is almost more interesting. Would you mind enlightening our Fiber Hooligan listeners today?
Well, it was a really wacky idea. My founding partner was Donna Mueller, who is now Donna Singer. We were young, stay-at-home moms, committed to weaving, and we wanted to make some extra money so that we could support our habit, which was an addiction to yarn. And we tossed around numerous ideas for what could we do to earn some money. We tried craft shows and hated them because what happened was you were weaving multiples of the same thing and not getting any time to weave what you wanted to weave. We finally came up with the idea of renting looms the way children at the time were able to rent musical instruments and take music lessons in school. That's long gone, but we still do rent looms. All of this actually hatched up at Harrisville Designs at a workshop with Mary Snyder. We were up there for 4 or 5 days and stayed in the dormitory, which was pretty primitive, and we worked this through. And we came home, we talked about it with our respective families, arranged a $3,000 loan from the Elkins savings account, and that probably pretty much depleted it. And we went back to Harrisville and told John Colony that we were going to rent looms and we were going to be his dealer. And I reminded him at our anniversary party at Convergence in Providence of his comment when we told him that. I mean, it never occurred to us to ask if this was something we could do. But his response to us was two words, "You're nuts." And we went from there. We bought 24-inch looms. And to save money, we loaded, actually, they may have been 22-inch looms, I've forgotten. To save money, though, we loaded them in pieces into our big boat of a Chevy station wagon and drove them home. To save a little more money, we only got one screwdriver for the Elkins and one screwdriver for Donna. We unloaded it all into our garage because that had to be the storage space, and we started building looms. And that was the very, very beginning.
So I have a note in my notes that it was New Year's Eve in 1980, and you two and your son Steve were painting your first official home of webs at...
That was about 4 years later after we left the house, right?
Actually, it was 6 years later.
6 years later, okay.
Right.
And we moved into a downstairs portion of the... newspaper building in Amherst, and it was a back entrance and a relatively small, covered with tobacco smoke, and we spent New Year's Eve repainting that store for the first official web store, the first time we were out of the house.
But there was a lot that happened in Amherst before, in our home before we started. And that was the beginning of the weaving classes. And Donna and I developed a 10-week, 3-hour-per-class course. And then our students took the looms home. They were renting them, so they could. They took the looms home to do their homework so that each week accounted for about 6 weeks, 6 hours of learning and homework. And to get these looms in and out of the house and into cars, we mostly relied on Art. The classroom was on a ground level entrance, but Art was teaching evenings, I believe in Pittsfield.
Pittsfield, yeah. I would get home at about 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, and there they were, all the students, ready to get their looms loaded in the cars. And that was me.
So the classes were immediately important, both to the development of the loom rental and just for teaching in itself.
Yes, absolutely. Now, it's important to remember, while this is all going on, of course, Art is helping out in the evenings, but Art, you're an academic. You know,
correct.
A PhD.
Yep.
You had a whole different kind of life.
Yep.
And so you'd go do your teaching thing, and I know that you did more than teaching. I have academics in my family, PhDs in my family, and it's ongoing. There's so many programs and chairs and all kinds of things that you have to do in that life that take up time outside the classroom, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a 40-hour a work week. So you're doing this very academic thing, and they're coming home for this very small business thing, very, very small business thing.
Well, I originally didn't do very much. I helped build some looms, and I did the loading of the looms at night when I got home on a Wednesday night. I wrote them a business plan for when Barbara and Donna started out the business. And I said, hey, you got to have a bookkeeping system. So I designed a bookkeeping system for them and kept their books for them so they could pay the proper taxes and get their bills paid and so forth. And that was about the extent of my involvement until 6 years later when Barbara moved into the downstairs building, and I did some painting for her. And it started to become a little more interesting, so I'd go in and hang around once in a while and do my bookkeeping there and get a little more involved in buying for her and so forth. And it was sort of a gradual involvement of me. And I think I taught a class for you one time, Bobby, didn't I?
On selling your crafts.
Selling your crafts, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you taught for Yarn Market News
Market News also, yeah.
And this was basically all still while you guys were on Kellogg Avenue. And while you were on Kellogg Avenue, you were growing. I mean, you were having employees. I mean, it's not the size that Webb's is now, but you were growing pretty steadily, correct?
Yeah. Well, we stayed in the newspaper office for about 2 to 3 years, and that became crowded. There was no room to move. There was no room to teach. I became very friendly with the building inspector because he really helped us out. He became very helpful in helping us redesign some of that space, but it became intolerable. It was too small. The business was growing. It wasn't fantastic, but it was growing enough so that it outgrew that space. And we decided we had to look for a building. And lo and behold, this building on Kellogg Avenue popped up. It had student apartments in it, but it was zoned commercial. So Barbara and I sat around and ruminated about this because at that time it was a big investment for us. And we ruminated about it, and finally we looked at each other and said, what's the worst thing that can happen is we own a piece of commercial property in downtown Amherst, which isn't a bad thing to have. And so we bought that building, Kellogg Avenue. We were landlords to student tenants for about a year until their leases were up. And then we bought that building and literally tore the entire inside out. It was nothing but a shell and two floors when we finished tearing it out. Filled about four roll-offs to go to the dump with the entire insides of that building and rebuilt it to the way we wanted it to be. And the building had two floors of about 600 feet on each floor, and an attic and a cellar and a barn out back. So we had a little space for a change. And but it didn't last very long. In about 2 years, we figured, about 2 to 3 years, we were literally bursting the walls out of that place.
So let's talk about the nature of your business. Well, you know, before we do that, let's talk about your move specifically. You made a decision to quit your day job and come and do this full time. When and how did that happen?
I kept my day job. I was doing little thing on Barbara and aside. Yeah, I didn't retire from UMass until about 3 or 4 years after we moved into Kellogg Avenue, about 1986. And I finally, I'm the type of person who needs to do different things. And Webb's was becoming a little bit more exciting. It was growing pretty well. We had discovered mail order and shipping packages around the world. And we were buying larger lots of mill ends and odd lots. It became a little bit more exciting. And I needed to do different things. And I was teaching for 28 years and it was getting routine and I was getting tired of it. And finally I came home one day and we were in debt up to our eyeballs, by the way, at that time. We owned the building. We had loans out for Webb's and so forth. But I came home and Barbara and I sat down and we figured out that we possibly could live on a small pension that I got and maybe Webb's would start being a money maker rather than a money eater. And we made that decision and it worked.
Again, risk taking. And my guess is that all your academic colleagues said the exact same thing that Harrisville said to you.
Yeah, you're nuts. They have done that. They still think I was nuts, probably. I gave up a tenured full professorship at a major university.
And 22 years later, they are still reminding him that they thought he was out of his mind. Because we're in contact.
Yeah, I was only 52 years old when I retired, by the way.
Right. So, okay, now we have a brand new dynamic. You're growing. You're moving. It seems like you can't stay put for very long because you keep busting at the seams. You guys are too successful. I know that a couple things happened that gave you a real advantage. But I got to ask before we get to the buying art, because you learned to do some really interesting buying ideas. Barbara, what was it like having him around all day, working with him all day?
Well, it was fun. I mean, he had arranged his university schedule so that he taught really early. As his disillusionment with teaching grew, he was on fewer committees. So he was at the store fairly early in the day, let's say about lunchtime. And we figured out that the way to work together basically 24/7 was that mostly we were in agreement, and when something came up that we had really different views on, the person who felt most strongly, whether it was yay or nay, was the one who, shall I say, won. And that balanced out so that sometimes what mattered a whole lot to me didn't matter all that much to Art, and sometimes what mattered a whole lot to him didn't matter so much to me. And so that has always worked out quite well.
Well, it sounds really smart. I mean, it sounds really smart. And at the time, my guess is in those early days, Art, you're doing a lot of the inventory, the bookkeeping, things like that. And Barbara, you're still doing a lot of teaching. Was that the breakdown at that point when you guys were pretty much doing it together?
Well, we were both involved in the buying. In terms of teaching, by this time we were offering several sections of beginning weaving and more advanced weaving classes. We would have workshops. We would invite teachers. We were teaching knitting as well and spinning. And on the weaving classes, we always insisted on consistency so that anyone who we hired to teach a beginning weaving class first had to sit through my beginning weaving class, so that if a student called the store and said, I have a problem on, say, class 6, what is it that those notes actually mean? Everybody knew what class 6 covered and was able to answer the question. So, and we always taught, regardless of what the course was, we always taught very structured classes so that everyone was doing the same thing at learning the same thing at the same time. And then once the course was over, the students had the knowledge they needed to do whatever they wanted. But basically, while their feet were under our table, they did what we said.
And you found that a recipe for success. People were satisfied. People were empowered.
I'm still talking to people who took the beginning weaving class yay back when and more recently. They all have their notes, and even if they take several years off because life gets in the way, when they decide to start again, the notes still work for them and it all comes back. So I'm a firm believer in teaching a structured course.
You sound very much like my father. He was I apprenticed for him for many, many summers in his weaving studio, and he was a stickler. He had his ways that he did things, and nothing wrong with it. It worked. At the time, it was a kind of a drag, but I was a kid, so everything's a drag. All right, I'd like to turn back over to you, Art, because one of the things that Webbs is well known for, that's something that you know you guys started before Steve was into it, was the way you buy. The way you can go out and find something different than a normal yarn store, not just going to market and buying, but looking for the deal. And you're really good at that. I heard you on the Ready, Set, Knit podcast talk about this, and I'd love it if you could share how you got into it and kind of your strategy with the Fiber Hooligan audience.
Well, very early on, we thought about how can we differentiate ourselves from just being another little yarn store or another little weaving store that gets stuck in a rut in a small town. And we hit upon, hey, maybe we can sell by mail. And we had a mailing list. I think it was, how many names? 80 names, Barbie, wasn't it?
We started with 60.
Yeah. And so we went out and we bought some mill ends. We found a supplier had some small lots of mill ends and odd lots, and we bought them up. Actually, we the same old big Chevrolet station wagon, we filled it up to the brim with yarn and brought it back to the store. And we knew nothing about dye lots or anything like that.
I'm not sure about that.
Well, we had some differing dye lots and so forth, but so it got a little harder. But we assembled a group of cut samples in folded pieces of paper with a description of the yarn on them in each piece of paper, put six or eight of them into an envelope with a cover letter, and sent it out to our 60 customers, and lo and behold, some orders came in. All by mail at that time. There was no internet, so everything went out by mail. Everything came back by mail, or once in a while. We had no 800 number, by the way, at that time. So if someone wanted to call it, it was on their nickel. And once in a while, the phone would ring. But lo and behold, some orders came in, a dozen, 15, 20 orders. And we filled them, and out the stuff went. And we said, hey, this may work. And so we started shopping in other locations for bigger and bigger lots. And it got to the point where I would go to the library and do some research. I think it was Thomas's Register at that time. You would sit in the library and find sources for yarn. And I have no reluctance to get on the phone and call anybody. And so I'd call people and say, do you have any odd lots of yarn for sale? A guy would say, yeah, we have about 40,000 pounds of this. Well, 40,000 pounds was too much for us at that time. And but I, you know, eventually found some smaller lots. And as we grew, we were buying larger and larger lots. And we started negotiating. And when I started learning how to negotiate better, we were getting better pricing. And finding these, and we got to the point. By the way, when we were on Kellogg Avenue, we were also renting an old railroad warehouse out in South Deerfield. So we started filling that place up. So we started finding more sources of yarn. We were buying bigger and bigger lots, and we had uh, uh, we had a sort of a philosophy. One, we would buy all of it, which our suppliers liked because we bought an entire lot. We didn't negotiate about color. We didn't negotiate about, I'll take 10 of these and 4 of these and 5 of these. We took the whole lot. Two, we paid our bills. And that was extremely important. It was at that time, a lot of people were not. And so we became a favored customer to a lot of these people. If they had something nice, they'd call us first. And we'd negotiate a price and basically start buying larger and larger lots. And it got to the point where we were starting to buy trailer loads of yarn. And it was... It became a lot of fun. I mean, we were starting to do that. And then we got into the buying odd lots and closeouts of knitting yarn. And we found out all these knitting yarn suppliers, when they ended up their season, would try to get rid of all the small lots and large lots that they had left of particular knitting yarns. And so we started buying those up. And we kind of built webs up on being able to offer really nice, first quality yarns out of some of the best sweater mills in the country, first quality knitting yarns that were closed out at some really ridiculously low prices, and lo and behold, that worked. And so we started building up, and we started advertising mill ends, odd lots, closeouts, and so forth. We started advertising that. We started working toward building up a larger mailing list, and we got that mailing list up to about 6,000 or 7,000 in no time, and we were getting a phenomenal hit rate on the mailing, but it was still very mechanical, very old. We still operate. We had an 800 number by that time. We negotiated with the phone company, got an 800 number, 1-800 for webs, and we said we had an 800 number, and that was the way you ordered. You ordered to either an 800 number, or you sent the color swatches back to us and said, I would like so many pounds of this, or so many bags of this, or so many skeins of this. and they would come back to us, and we would fill the orders mechanically, and we would do the billing by hand, and away it goes. It was a very crude system, but it worked.
So while this was all, and this is genius, by the way, I mean, because you're aggressive. You guys keep taking chances. You keep investing in what you believe in. And I like that. No fear.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we were big risk takers. Yeah, we were big risk takers. And our banker had our signature on a lot of loans at that time.
Including one on our house.
Including several on our house. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Well, you know, as a small business people ourselves, we do get that. We've been there. Absolutely, we've been there. You know, you guys have been phenomenally successful. Now, as you're doing this and as you're moving into ends for knitting yarn, obviously you're putting, you know, you're not just sending all of this stuff out the door. You're also stocking it in your store as well, and so you've got more variety and maybe more attraction for knitters and crocheters and those kinds of people. Did you see an uptick in that part of your business, Barbara, in the store?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Knitting, we actually started with knitting on Main Street because we're right near the colleges. We're in between all the 5 colleges in the area. And students would come in looking for knitting yarns, and so obviously we put in some knitting needles. We didn't have them much in the way of what we always called shiny label yarns. But we'd sell them rug wool and say, you skein it off, you take it home, you wash it, and you can make a sweater. And then we added Lopi, and then we started teaching knitting. And gradually the knitting developed, and by the time we were in the wonderful old Victorian house on Kellogg Avenue downtown, we had the first floor was a good part of the main floor was knitting yarns, and the second floor was coned yarns. So we saw, and we added patterns, of course, and all the odds and ends that you need. So we saw the development of knitting too, and I had actually been knitting from the time I was about 5, and so we were fully capable of selling knitting and supplies with the support that it needed. And on the mill end yarns, we bought low, but we also sold low. So it wasn't a question of we were getting high prices for these yarns that we bought very, very reasonably. We were passing that savings on. And we also always had discounts for quantity.
Right. I want to make a real quick comment to the Fiber Hooligan listeners. It's very possible that many of the listeners are not weavers so much as they are knitters. That's mm-hmm. pretty common. When we talk about the shiny balls as in relationship to the cones, if you're a strictly weaving place and weaving centric, you really want yarn on cones. Lots of it, because it's you want it forever, and you know you're warping looms. It's so an old-fashioned weaving place wouldn't have a lot of balls of yarn on the shelves. That's pretty normal. And I just wanted to make that comment in case Fiber Hooligan listeners were a little confused about that.
You might have skeins, though.
You might have some skeins.
Hand-dyed skeins.
Hand-dyed skeins and skeins of yarn. Weavers buy that quite a bit, so there might be a lot of skein yarn in a weaving store. But and we did. I mean, these little specialty skeins of hand-dyed yarns or luxury yarns, silks, and so forth come in smaller skeins, so that weavers can have them in smaller quantities rather than having to buy a large cone. So the knitters could partake of that as well. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely, and they do. I've seen knitters do that. We've all seen knitters do that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so you're diversifying and you're bringing in your crowd. Your list is growing. At this point, had you gone to the internet yet?
No. We were still in Kellogg Avenue, and it was still send those samples out and rely either on the telephone or the samples coming back to us in a mail order. It was strictly mail order. The internet had really not started yet. It was the late 1980s, very early 1990s, and the internet was not even a factor yet. That started after we had moved over to Northampton. But while we were in Kellogg Avenue, and indeed even in the time at the beginning of Northampton, we were still a very mechanical hand operation. And so was the rest of the world. The internet boom did not start at that time.
Right. So let's talk about your move over to Northampton, because I understand that there was some angst over the move to Northampton.
A little bit, yeah. Particularly with Barbara, but I'll let her tell you about that.
I got the sense from listening, and again, I'm so lucky to be able to have heard your past episodes. You've been featured one per quarter on Ready, Set, Knit, and it's been wonderful to listen to those as well, that Northampton was not your favorite idea in the world, Barbara.
No. Well, we live now about, and I've always lived about, less than a mile from where the store on Kellogg Avenue was located. And we Amherst was our town. And we looked at lots of buildings that were totally inappropriate. Nobody understood what we were. Our suppliers didn't understand. The realtors certainly didn't understand. And they'd show us totally inappropriate places. And it got to the point where one time we said, you know, we think they just think that we want to go for a ride in their car. But we looked at tons of places and realized that we weren't going to find the space that we needed in Amherst. And so I yielded on that. There was no question that we just could not grow out of Kellogg Avenue anymore, and we could not find space. Once we found a building that seemed like it had a lot of possibilities, but it didn't work out, and it, in hindsight, it was best that it didn't. So Art called an acquaintance of his that he had known at UMass, who was now working in Northampton, told her what we needed, and it barely took her 3 days to make a suggestion for a building that was about 20,000 square feet, had a parking lot, was a half mile off of Interstate 91, was on the edge of downtown, which was just fine for what we needed. And we went to see it, and it was horrific. The walls were, it had been a garage, it had been the bus company garage, it had been the taxi company. It was...
I just have to interject here. I don't know how many of your listeners remember the a car brand called Rio, R-E-O.
And not very many are.
Not very many, but it was in the 1930s, and this was I found a sign on the wall on the outside that advertised Rio cars. So this
That's
building
great.
was a dealership for Rio at one time in its life. But it had many incarnations, and the last one of which was a telephone company garage. But go ahead, Bobby.
Okay, and the trucks were parked in what is now our warehouse, and there were drains in the floor so the trucks could be washed, and there were gas lines coming down from the building and gas pumps out front, and steel overhead doors both in the front and the back of the building. And it smelled cigarette fumes, and the walls were disgusting, and there was no ceiling. It just all went up to the roof, which was, in terms of warehouse space, a great thing. But it was pretty awful. And we would look, and I'd find one excuse or another, and the would-be landlord would let us sit for a while and then call and say, but, you know, we could do whatever. And this happened a few times. And finally, I thought I had the ultimate reason not to go there. And I said, well, you know, it just won't be safe for the cats. And we had two store cats at the time, Gracie and Bear. And the landlord, the would-be landlord said, I understand about pets. We'll fence a space in the back for them. And that was the end of my defenses.
So I've got this great article that was published by the folks at Webbs, 110 gallons of undiluted fantastic later.
Right. That
made a lot of rebuilding.
That diluted down to about 2,000 gallons of cleaner.
Yep. And so, Barbara, did it become the thing that you needed it to become? Did it get reinvented in a way that made you feel, okay, yes, this can be home?
Yeah, well, it actually got to be pretty perfect because we set up the front as the retail store. We were limited by zoning to 2,500 square feet for retail, and the rest in the back of the primary building became warehouse, and no ceiling was just fine because we were, at the time, we didn't have the shelving, but we were able to go up higher. And then this little metal building on the side became an office for us. There had been a work table set up that in one of the rooms that we kept as the place where we did our sampling. And then there was another room where the orders were filled. And then another space that became the shipping room, and UPS would come to that door. And there was space for a lunchroom. And on the other side of the building, there were individual rooms that we could load with a specific type of yarn. So we had the rug wool room. We had the
chenille room,
the six-ply rayon room, because at that time we had thousands of pounds of a wonderful kind of 5/2 equivalent six-ply rayon. We had a place for the knitting needles and a place for the knitting yarns. So it worked quite well for a while. We in a lot of cases, we just stacked 200-pound cartons of Milans on top of each other, and bit by bit, art accumulated used shelving because we were really not in a position to buy new shelving at the time, and we had to kind of jigger it to make it stand up sometimes, but it did work. And we had a classroom, so we could continually teach, and it all was very good in the beginning. And then we started filling it.
Oh, yeah.
It didn't take long, did it?
Didn't take long. No.
And so what was the next move? I mean, what did you do? You filled it all, and how long did you manage to last there?
Well, we built it up, and then the second part of the building became available, and we rented the front half of it first, and then eventually the back half moved out also, and we rented the back half of the next door. So we added about another 8,000 feet of space, and started filling that up with yarn. Barbara and I would go on these yarn buying trips. Our legendary one was when we went to North Carolina. We drove all around the state, and we'd look for a water tower, and underneath that water tower was probably a textile mill, and it usually was. And so we'd look for water towers and head toward the water tower and just walk into a textile mill and say, "Do you have anything for sale?" And sometimes no, sometimes yes, sometimes it worked, but they would always direct us somewhere else. And so we would go somewhere else. It was a kind of very successful trip through North Carolina. We met an awful lot of interesting people, saw an awful lot of old mills, some of which are no longer there, and made a lot of connections. And we bought a lot of yarn.
You had to eventually get a warehouse elsewhere as well.
Oh, that's Steve and Kathy bought the warehouse, and that's much later on. We lasted quite a bit because we had space to go up as well. So if we couldn't, the floor space didn't work out, we'd stack higher, and we had very high ceilings, so we were able to go upwards as well. So we were lasting pretty well. It wasn't the most. The packers were getting in the way of each other, and the pickers were getting in the way of each other. And sometimes, and of course, the customers shopped in the warehouse as well, so they'd get in the way of the pickers and packers. But it all, it was fun. It worked. But it was getting a little crowded, and that when Steve and Kathy took over.
Yes. Now, at some point, you heard about this interesting thing happening called the Internet, and you thought it might catch on.
Yep.
And you heard about this thing called a URL or a domain name, and you probably, I think that not a single person in the industry is not absolutely green with envy about the choice you got. And
well, it was serendipity. What we went for webs.com. And it was taken. This was well before anybody was even on the Internet. It was in the early 90s, and we were using we had a rudimentary website, and we had some email addresses. I'm not sure we were using them very much, but we had email addresses. And but we were using the URL of our server, supplier, and I read this article, "You ought to have your own." And so I called him up, and he came over with the laptop, and I said, "Well, let's search out and see if we can find webs.com or something like that." And it was taken, I forget by whom, somebody in Houston, I think. And so we said, "Well, what can we do?" I said, "Why don't we try yarn.com?" And we put in yarn.com, and it wasn't taken. So we grabbed it. We've had it since. Steve chides me. He says, "You should have taken everything else that was available. for $35, you can get your URL. You can grab up a whole bunch of them." But we were so excited we got yarn.com. And so everybody is I got a call one time from a guy who offered to buy yarn.com. I won't tell you what he offered me, and I won't tell you what my rebuttal was, but it was pretty funny, and his offer was quite low.
Well, I remember it was probably in the 90s. I was at a show and was talking to somebody about this whole thing. This is before I was a techno person myself. You know, since then I've become quite the geek. But I understood the nature of the internet. I understood the nature of the domain, and I was talking to a teacher, and they were saying, "Could you believe that they got yarn.com? That's going to be priceless someday." And I said, "You know, I think you're probably right, but you know, who knows? Maybe this internet thing won't catch on. I don't know. We'll see." But that was the early 90s. Yeah, so you were way out there in the future. Now, at the point that you had the website and had some email addresses, my guess is it took a little bit of time for you to start doing e-commerce through your website.
Yeah. We would post, we hooked up with an advertising agency that was getting a little familiar with the e-commerce world. And we would post up what our offerings were on the internet. We did not, however, have an ordering cart, a shopping cart, nor the security that one would need to have it at that time. And so our items were posted up on the internet along with as best we could do with color reproductions. I think in the first time we just posted a picture of the yarn and listed the colors in our first rudimentary website, and we would list the offering for the month or the quarter that we sent out the samples for. We were still sending out samples. We were still sending out hand samples, but we did list it on the internet. But you had to call the 800 number to order. We had no ordering mechanism, and I think at the end, by the time we turned the business over to Steve and Kathy, I think we were starting to get a shopping cart onto our website, but it was very, very rudimentary. It was nowhere near what the sophistication they have now, or that anybody has now. And of course, that was the time also that the dot-coms were going bust. If you remember the early 90s and the mid 90s, when the dot-coms were exploding all over, you'd have toy companies that couldn't deliver toys at Christmas, and send some 6-year-old a gift certificate, but instead of his toy, but they were all going bust, and a lot of people were looking at the internet and saying, "Ah, it will never work." But we were posting up, and we were getting 800 number calls off the internet. And we were also started to advertise. One of our ads was just a sheep's head, if I remember correctly, and just the word yarn.com. And that would be the ad, a little ad in amongst the classifieds in many of the magazines that we advertised in.
I remember that. I actually remember that ad, and I remember you. I actually think you and I might have even talked about that at a Stitches. Maybe it was even at King of Prussia about the internet, because I was really curious about the whole thing. And it was something that you started branding with right away on a lot of your stuff, and I think that was really smart.
Right, and so that little ad would didn't cost a lot. You pop it right into a classified section, but it would stick out on the page because there was that sheep's head with yarn.com, and it worked. And of course, very recently, after the 90s, the internet started gaining steam, and now it's quite a phenomenon.
As I always say to people, again, I think it's okay. I think this internet thing is going to catch on.
Yeah, it's working. It's working pretty well.
I think so. Yeah, and the website is so dynamic. Yarn.com is
fantastic on that website. Yeah,
they really do. But they got started with some good stuff. So, do you mind talking a little bit about that transition that happened when you guys decided it was time to retire, and Steve and Kathy decided that they wanted to come in?
It wasn't
that simple.
A hard sell, Took my best salesmanship. Actually, we decided we wanted to retire. We had an arrangement with an employee that didn't work out. And then we said to our employees, we had about 12 to 14 employees at that time. We said to employees, we said, look, Barbara and I want to take it a little easier. And we also want to go on vacation every 3 months. So if you guys keep working at the pace we're working and we keep growing a little and let Barbara and I go on vacation for a week every 3 months, we'll keep this business going and we'll all be happy. And they all bought into that concept. And then we let it be known that Webb's was for sale. And we had one or two people come in who got serious, and then one person came in and said, I've got the money and my accountant thinks it's going to work and so forth. And I said, uh-oh, we got to talk to the kids before we make this move. Because we'd talked to them two or three times in the past and they always turned us down. Both Steve and Kathy had fairly high-powered jobs with good Fortune 500 corporations. And they looked at us and said, we don't want to work at that place. And
I think Steve said, come home again?
Yeah. He said, I don't want to do what my parents were doing. But we got this one relatively serious woman who came in and I said, we better talk to the kids. We called them up and we said, let's have dinner. And I went with every spreadsheet I could make up and all kinds of tax forms and so forth. And we went to dinner and I said, you've got to take this. Here it is. And I laid it all out for them. And Kathy was immediately interested. Steve took a little while, but eventually they both agreed and took it over.
Well, it's so great that they did, and they have your same kind of risk-taking philosophy there. They're aggressive, fair, just delightful to work with. I was in a similar situation about 10 years ago when again they were talking about retiring and selling, and I kind of got this lump in my throat, and I swore I'd never come back. I swore I'd never come back.
Yeah.
I don't want to do what my folks are doing, but it's seductive. It happens, folks. It really does. It gets emotional, but they're delightful, and they really have done an amazing amount of work. Again, they built the new warehouse. I was out there. I saw that, and the webs.com website and the e-commerce and all the social media. I mean, it's Webs is now an internet power to be reckoned with. You got to be proud of the kids.
Oh yeah.
Very much so. They've done a fantastic job, and they just took off running. And right away, I said, I got to get out of their way. And Barbara still goes in, but she's not in charge anymore. They're running the show. Barbara goes in to weave and talk to our weaving customers. I go in occasionally. Both Barbara and I handle pretty much handle the computer. Loom business that we've developed. We do the installation and the repairs and the technical work and the training and so forth on the computer operated looms.
Toyka
looms that we sell. It's their show. They're running it and they're doing a marvelous job with it. And we're very, very pleased and proud. By the way, that's another relationship, by the way, that Barbara and I established with Toyko of Finland. We're now their U.S. distributor for their looms, and they make a wonderful computer-operated loom that we've been selling and distributing around the country. And both on a professional and personal level, we've developed a strong relationship with that company in Finland.
Yeah, I had not seen those until I came to your store, again, about 2 years ago. And then Steve kind of told me all about them. Very interesting.
Yeah. And that's the niche that I've carved out for myself that I'm enjoying. I do all the repairs and I do all the technical questions that people call in with. And Barbara does a lot of the training on the software, and we sell those looms, and we've been very successful. We've had a lot of fun with them, and we've been to Finland 4 times, and lovely country, and we always have a good time there.
Barbara, you're never going to get out of the weaving world, are you?
Probably shortly after Steve and Kathy took over, I told them I was sorry, I lied to them, but I have absolutely no plans to retire. That's been my life for way too long to just walk away. So I will never get out of the weaving room, and I really enjoy talking to customers just on the weaving. I don't know where the knitting yarns are anymore. My knitting skills are not what our staff knitting skills are, and they don't need me in the knitting area. But in terms of weaving, I mean, I've been weaving for longer than Webbs has been Webbs, for a whole lot longer. And we now have a manager of the weaving area, and she's actually the granddaughter of a woman who was in my guild way back when, and that's kind of fun. And so I make suggestions, but I have never gotten in the way, and there are days when I don't even see Steve and Kathy, even though we're in the same building. But for me, it's about the weaving, and now I can develop fabrics, and we publish the drafts, and we sell the yarn, and we have the samples of the fabrics on display in the store. And the Toika is just my love, and I am very happy to sell them.
By the way, Barbara just mentioned staff. One of the things that Steve and Kathy have done is develop this incredible staff, really talented people, good customer services. Our customer service unit is exemplary, and the store staff is fantastic. I've sat and watched them in awe sometimes, handle customers, wait on customers, handle customers need to be walked through a project. Just an incredible group of people.
And all the tech stuff, the stuff, the behind-the-scenes areas that are not visible are all staffed by almost entirely people promoted from within, which develops such loyalty within the company.
I think it's really interesting. I've got another stat here I'm going to throw out to the Fiber Hooligan listeners. At your Amherst, 18 Kellogg Avenue, Amherst store, by March of 1992, your staff included fewer than a dozen employees. And
right.
Here we are today, and Webbs today has over 5 times that many employees.
Yeah.
Yep. In fact, I'm just doing a slideshow that we, Barbara and I, are going to do on Monday night at a local history museum. And one of the pictures we've got is a staff picture. And I started counting the number of people in that staff picture. And I believe I got up to 64 when I lost count of where some of these people were. And so it's grown, yeah, quite a bit. Most of them know me, but I don't know all of them, but I know quite a few of them. And it's nice to say hi to a lot of smiling faces in the morning. They're good people.
They are good people. And again, so competent.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that speaks well of management, that they feel free to be competent. And I think it really does. The Greeks have a saying, the fish rots from the head. And most failures, I feel, are failures of management, not employees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You train them well. You select them. You be very selective on people. You train them well. You give them responsibility, and you hold them responsible. And it works out beautifully. And that's basically what management is, making sure that your people have the resources to do the job, and the freedom to do the job and the will to do the job, and it works. And we used to have one, even when we had our 12 employees, we used to tell our employees, you know, make a decision. You're not going to cost us the business. You're not going to cost us a lot of money if you make a wrong decision. Just make a decision. And we also told our employees to make sure that customer is happy. Make sure that customer is satisfied. Don't let a customer go away angry, because, you know, the old adage in retail, if you lose a customer, you lose three.
Yes, I think I agree with you on that. I also know, you know, a little bit about how much it takes to replace a customer from a financial standpoint, as opposed to retaining a customer. I mean, and we're not talking about three times. We're talking about like 10 or 11 times the actual cost to develop that customer, a new customer, back into what you've lost. It's amazing.
Absolutely.
So here we are, Art and Barbara. It's 40 years. 40 years. I mean, that's amazing. I mean, that's incredible. As you look back, you know, do you have any kind of like final thoughts or reflections that you'd like to share with the Fiber Hooligan audience? That what has 40 years meant? I mean, what does this all mean?
Oh, 40 years has been my life. I can't imagine having had any other work that would have been so gratifying. I mean, family, of course, is primary, but getting out there and doing something for a job, for a career, has just been the most rewarding thing I think we could possibly have done. And I think that Art will probably be remembered longer for what he's done at Webbs than for all the great stuff he did at the university. There's one thing that we haven't talked about, though, that I'd just like to put a little plug in for, and that's the Valley Yarns.
Yeah, great. I'm glad you brought that up, Barbara, because Valley Yarns is something I did want to get to. And, you know, this is something that's very interesting because you did this early on, well before other retailers were bringing in their own lines or custom lines. Let's talk about Valley Yarns for a bit.
Many years ago, as we saw suppliers disappear, and mill ends disappear, we realized that we had to replace them with something. And so we started having yarns made for us. And over time, we settled on the, first it was, we would just call them the Webbs line. And then shortly after Steve and Kathy came in, I believe, we all agreed that we would call our private label yarns, Valley Yarns. Our corporate name is Valley Fibers Corporation, so that all fit. And we had a label designed, and the knitting yarns are generally named after an area in the Connecticut River Valley. So, the most recent yarn is called Leiden, and we had something called Long Meadow, and we had something called Wildwood, which was the name of our street, and so forth.
Actually, our decision way back when one huge sweater mill where we used to get a lot of 8-2 and 6-2 and 10-2 cotton closed. And when that closed, that was a supplier for a lot of our yarn brokers. They literally dried up. The yarn brokers got a little older, retired, couldn't get more yarn. And we're looking around and saying, you know, that's our bread and butter. And so, way early, Barbara and I said, we've got to go looking for our own sources of yarn. And you tried American Mills, and American Mills started going out of business. The large cotton yarn mills in the South literally went under. Huge names like Old Dixie Yarns and Standard Goose of Thatcher, SCD Yarns, went out of business. And So we started sourcing, and we built up lines of cone yarns for weavers, and incidentally, we started adding a few knitting yarns. The first one we added was a heavy Worcester weight cotton that we named Park Square, which is a square in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, where we had a little condo that we retired to during the summer. But Park Square was a heavy Worcester weight knitting yarn. So we started adding a few knitting yarns. And then when Steve and Kathy came in, they really expanded the knitting yarn business. And I think we now have about 25 knitting yarns under the Valley Lake.
I think it's more than that even.
It could be up to 30. But we also have a slew of weaving yarns. And basically that was economy driven. Simply there were no mills left anymore. And even the knitting yarn mills, which used to be all American, started going. I don't know if you remember the name Brunswick. I don't know if you remember the name Burnett and so forth. These were American knitting yarn mills. And they started, then they went out of business. It simply became uneconomical to make textiles in the United States. And we saw that. We saw that early, and we planned for it, and thus our own lines came into being.
Right, right. And one of the things that's happening with the 40th anniversary that I've talked about with Steve when he was on the show is that he's picked four hand dyers out there who have taken the Valley Yarns and dyed using their mm-hmm. sensibilities as a special 40th anniversary, each coming out once a quarter. Very exciting. Yeah. Very exciting.
Yeah. You know, I'm impressed with these people. They're young, and they're active, and we met several of them at our 40th anniversary party, and they're young, and they're really impressive. They're aggressive, and I have some high hopes for the specialty yarn business in the United States, because I see these people who are, you know, when you in the early days when we started out, the hand dyers who made these specialty, they show up at craft shows, they'd show up at King of Prussia with a very small booth and so forth, but very few of them, maybe with one exception, had the inspiration to go national and to go into wholesaling these yarns to yarn stores. But you're seeing that now, and you're seeing it with these young people, and I'm really impressed and really pleased to see that, because, you know, I just love to see people build businesses, and I think that's the hope of the industry for a little while, at least.
Well, I think it is. I mean, of course, the industry's changing. We can all feel that,
and
you know that it's. And I know that over time, and I think you probably can speak to this. I mean, there are ups and downs within the industry. I mean, there certainly have been downs in the industry where it's been hard for people, and there have been you know, the scarf days, you know, and things like that. I mean, it's these things do go in cycles, and if you're around long enough, you realize that you know, we're probably going to be okay. Things will just change, and they always have changed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, back in the old yarn store days, every local yarn store was afraid of the catalog, the mail order catalog. And now they're all afraid of the internet. And you know, it's just is what it is. Things change. But one thing that remains the same: hiring good people, getting good deals on product, and doing good customer service. And those things will always be a part of a successful business.
Mm, you're right. Absolutely.
And all the other stuff is just methods. It's all just methods, and it can be learned. So I'm going to put you on the spot here for a minute. We're coming down close to the end of the interview, and it's been wonderful talking to you. And I think the Fiber Hooligans, I know that they're going to love listening to this show. Do you have any words of advice for maybe one of my listeners that's thinking about being entrepreneurial and getting into the industry? Do you have any words of advice, both of you? And we'll start with you first, Barbara.
One thing is you've got to be able to take risks. You've got to be able to get by on very little income for quite a while, because you've got to plow it all back in. And you got to stick with it. One of our former employees bought a yarn store not too long ago. It's quite a distance from here. And she jumped in with both feet. She knew that there were going to be risks. She knew that she had to be very creative, both in what she did in the store and in how she ran the business. And everything I hear is that it's working out for her. She took a deep breath, she thought about it carefully, and she said, this is what I want to do. I've got to try it.
My advice to would-be entrepreneurs is to remember that you're running a business.
Mm-hmm.
You may love yarn. Oh, I love yarn. Well, you know, we all love yarn. But that's not the prime reason you're there. You're there to run a business. And there are certain times when you've really got to make decisions to make sure that business grows, and you've got to be a risk taker, and you've got to run that business well. You've got to have some controls. You've got to have some cost controls. You've got to have some budgeting skills. All the things that go into running a business are the important things. And it's not just loving yarn. It's running that business effectively and efficiently. Making the things we talked about before, making sure your employees are trained, empowered, have skills, and so forth, and can make decisions. And can make decisions as you would want them to be made, which requires training. This, I think, is the most important lesson I could impart on people who are thinking of taking the leap, is to make sure you run it as a business.
Well, those are smart words, and I really appreciate it. I thought it would be a terrible tragedy if two such successful people as yourselves, I didn't ask you for the benefit of our listening audience today. So I do appreciate your words of wisdom. I want to congratulate you for 40 years of a wonderful, stalwart business in our industry. And I want to thank you so much for being on the show with me today.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. We enjoyed it. And wish you the best of everything, too. I mean, we've watched you grow as well. We grew together.
Yeah, I guess we did. I mean, it's funny. I know it sounds corny, but it is kind of a tight knit group, and we've all known each other for a long time.
Yeah.
You guys knew us when we were still the Golden Fleece, before we
That's
published
right.
a darn thing.
I remember. I remember growing up with lots of people in this industry, and the early days of Yarn Market News when they were in Asheville, North Carolina.
Right.
And we would go for seminars. We'd run seminars there in the early days. So lots of people we grew up with. Some still here. Some still around. Some not. But it's been a lot of fun. It really has been.
It has been a lot of fun. Well, I'm going to let you folks go today. I want to, again, thank you for your time and wish you both a glorious week.
And same to you.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Take Bye-bye.
Care. Bye-bye.
That was Art and Barbara Elkins, the founders of Webbs, America's Yarn Store. You can find out what's going on at Webbs at yarn.com, if that's not too hard for you to remember. And the other thing I'm going to recommend is that you subscribe and listen to their podcast, Ready, Set, Knit, because Art and Barbara have been doing a series of podcasts that are really great to listen to, and there's a lot more in-depth information in those podcasts than you heard here today. Okay, you know what time it is.
And now it's time for State of the Hooligan with Tammy Burke.
Ah, I'd like to welcome back host of State of the Hooligan, moderator of our Fiber Hooligans Rivalry Group, and administrator of our Fiber Hooligans Facebook page to tell us all what's new and cool in the fiber arts world, our roving virtual reporter, my friend and fellow Fiber Hooligan, Tammy Burke. Tammy joins us again today from Boise, Idaho. Good morning, Tammy, and welcome back to the show.
Good morning, Benjamin. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday. It's just never going to get old for you, is it? It's going to continue to tickle you forever, isn't it?
How are you?
You know, I'm totally stressed.
Oh, I thought you'd be so excited. Don't be stressed.
Folks, have you ever gone through this? I've never done this before, where I'm selling a house and buying a house on the same day, and it's two different title companies. You know, on Friday at 8 o'clock in the morning, I have to meet with one of the title companies to sell my house. And that's because I need to sell my house in order to have the money to buy my house at the next title company, slightly across town 2 hours later. At the same time, that's happening at 8 o'clock in the morning, the first one, folks. At the same time, the movers are showing up at 8 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, thank goodness I have Jessica Nelson, who, you know, Jess, I mean, she's wonderful to be around. So she'll be around handling things. But I also have my dear daughter, Sam, and Christopher and Gabriel. Dear daughter, Sam, dear son, Christopher, dear son, Gabriel. I don't want to include them as dear daughters, but they'll be here handling the move while we're doing all this stuff. And so, you know, then you do the titles, you get the keys, and then you race back to the new house so that you can beat the movers there to unlock the door and move in. It's far too stressful. Didn't these things usually happen over a couple of days and there was some courtesy back in the old days where you kind of had a little overlap? Didn't that used to be the way?
That used to be the way. I think people get all their friends connected and everybody gets in there and makes a party out of it. So I'm glad you have Jessica. She's probably the voice of calm.
Well, I mean, you know Jessica. You've worked with her at the shows before. I mean, she's, you know.
Nothing phases her.
Well, and she's just such a hard worker, too. I mean,
yes.
You know, Jessica, you know, just so you know, if I haven't said it lately, we love you. It's wonderful to have me in my corner. But yeah, so, you know, it's Monday, and on Friday morning, I will be moving. And then I'll be, you know, folks, I want to tell you up front, we're going to be taking another week off because I don't even know if my internet is going to be hooked up by Monday next week. And I certainly won't have time next week to record another show and put it out. So we're going to be taking a 2 week break, and then we'll come back with a show just before Stitches East on the Monday before Stitches East. But I'm a little stressed. We got some kind of big promotional plans that we're trying to push through for the show, I'm feeling old.
Aw, well, it'll be over soon. It won't last forever. That's my first piece of advice.
Yeah, I mean, you fiber hooligans don't mind if I whine a little bit because, well, I'm going to anyway. But
I think now everybody will understand why we're not hearing from you for a little bit. So thank you for letting us know.
It's going to be kind of sucky not talking to you for a week.
Oh, well, I'll be typing around Ravelry and trying to get people excited about going to Stitches East this coming up.
So are you all set? Did my crew get plane tickets and hotels and all that kind of stuff already set up for you?
I'm sure they have.
Okay.
we're a little early on that as we're recording, but I'm sure they have.
Okay, good. I hope so, because it's coming up. It's coming up darn quick.
Yes.
So it's coming up a darn quick, you know? You know, and it's so funny because Hartford was where you were supposed to come for your very first Stitches. That was supposed to be the plan. Remember, you were going to come out with Steve and you guys were going to hang out in Hartford?
And you know what? Having gone to West first and as ginormous as that was, you know, I'm totally thrilled and not at all nervous about being at these other venues. So,
yeah, starting with West is definitely a trial by fire. Absolutely.
So much to see, so many things to do, so many people. So,
I know. So, how about you? Let's talk about you. I'm tired. I'm sick to death of me. So, let's talk about you. What have you been doing? So, you've been crocheting, I hear, and you're not happy?
I just don't enjoy it as much as knitting. But I'm trying to work through get some things off the table and out of the way before I buy new yarn at Stitches East.
So, you know, the reason that you're going to be buying some more Azjaziz is because your stash is completely empty. You have nothing left, right?
I'm just trying to work through all the works in progress so that I can come home with new inspiration for the stash I have at home.
Did you hear that, folks? You notice how she just elegantly avoided that question? She said she's got works in progress that she wants to finish, which we can all understand. That we can all give her applause. But you notice how she didn't say, oh, no, I don't need any more stash. I just want any more stash. Because that would have been the honest answer that she didn't give us.
I have a big knit-along coming up with Marley Bird. It's a major project. And that's another reason why I'd like to have the decks cleared, ready to go.
And yet, folks, did you notice that she turned into another cool thing that she was doing and still has not answered the question? Okay, so I'm going to put it to you so you can't get out of this.
Okay.
I'm not talking about what you're doing. I'm not talking about what you're working on or what you're trying to finish or the next gig campaign. Is your stash depleted? And that's the reason that you need to go buy some more stash.
Not at all.
Okay, finally. Let's just get to the truth here. You don't have to justify it. It's totally fine. But, you know, did you see her do that sidestep on that, folks? I certainly saw that, you know. A million different answers for a question that didn't actually answer the question. Every so often, I'm going to catch you on this. So you heard me, folks. I finally got to the answer to that. Now all of you are going to be mad at me because I picked on her. And you say, leave her alone because we totally understand her rationale, right? Yeah, okay, fine. I'll leave her alone.
I don't want to gloat and make my stash look bigger than anybody else's. I just don't want to be overwhelmed by it either. Anyway, on to today's topic.
Yes, I always look forward to your reports. And so what are we talking about this week?
Have you ever heard of the city in Eastern Oregon called Pendleton?
No.
Pendleton is kind of got a long history. Originally became sort of world famous because they had the Pendleton Roundup, which is a big cowboy event. A lot of the early cowboys in the black and white movies were found at the Pendleton Roundup. There's also a Pendleton Powwow, Native American gathering. Pendleton is also known for, in Fiber World, the Pendleton Woolen Mills.
Okay.
So all those great woolen blankets, all those great wonderful plaids, American made, were all made out of Pendleton, Oregon. Michael and I, were traveling through the area listening to the classic rock station and heard an ad on the radio for the Spinnin'. They were inviting all the knitters, all the crocheters, all the weavers, all the spinners, all the dyers, anybody that wanted to gather every first Saturday of the month at the Pendleton Art Center. Wonderful opportunity. I actually called and spoke with the director, and she says that it's really exciting for them because people come from hours away to be at this event. A couple weeks ago when we talked to Karen Skissel, she was talking about living in the Tri-Cities. She was saying people came from as far away as that, which is at least, I think, about an hour, bringing their handcrafts. It's exciting for the event to happen on the first Saturday of the month because that's when they change the exhibits all over in the Art Center. So everybody gets a chance to look at all of that and also to share in the fiber events. She says her sister owns a yarn shop near Austin, Texas. So I'm thinking that may have been where she got the inspiration for this event. But it's been very popular in the area, even though there's not a lot of people living in Pendleton now. The excitement about this seems to be pretty wonderful, I think. And it sounds awesome just to have it advertised on the rock station. My husband heard it and he says, honey. So that was neat.
Well, I think it's really cool when you can get like a fiber event and a classic rock station. I mean,
there you go.
So you go Led Zeppelin, commercial for a fiber event, The Who, you know, another commercial for a fiber event. I mean, that sounds like an area that people should want to live in.
I think so. It's the center of a lot of wheat fields. The big attraction just happened. The Pendleton Roundup just happened in mid-September. So a lot of people have been traveling through the area to get there for that. So it's a lot of sheep fields, a lot of wheat fields. You know, just wonderful big rural area, open fields. And I think that it probably attracts a lot of people just for the fiber event.
Cool. Well, that's very cool. And you're going to post links to this stuff up on the Ravelry group so we can read more about?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's cool. That's very cool. So are you going to try to get over to it, or is that happening while we're at Stitches?
So it would be the weekend before Stitches. I work Saturday, so it's going to take some time for me to organize a Saturday off to drive over. But I am trying. I'm looking forward to trying to be there.
Cool. Do me a favor. Take some pics.
I will.
If you go over, and let's push your pics up on the Ravelry group, too.
That'd be awesome. I think people might like to get to see.
We're going to start a new contest. We're in the, you know, not where's Wally, but where's Tammy. That's what we'll do.
Yes. Sure.
Where's Waldo? It's where's Waldo instead of where's Tammy, not Wally. It's been too long since I was a kid. I need to be more kid-like. Okay, well, enough. I'm fragmented now. All right. So you got anything else that you want to talk about this week before we
packing to go to Stitches West. I mean, Stitches East.
Stitches East. You're packing to go to Stitches East, yes. And you've reconsidered, and you're only going to take 3 projects and not 6, right?
So says you.
Yeah, I knew it. Well, okay. Well, that's great. So wish me luck on the move later this
week. You'll survive.
Yeah. I know I'll survive. And I've got good people. I got great kids. I got Jess. I got a professional moving company. I got a great realtor, you know. And lots of details are being taken care of. So it'll all be okay. And, you know, next time we broadcast, I'll be in a brand new office in a different house, which will be kind of cool. So
it'll probably sound different.
I think it actually will. I think the service over there is a little better, I'm in an open area downstairs now, and I'll have a kind of a closed off office. Hopefully the sound will be a little better too. But anyway, enough of that. So I want to thank you for another great segment, Tammy, and we'll look forward to hearing from you in 2 weeks. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday. Take care, Benjamin.
You too. That was Tammy Burke, host of State of the Hooligan and admin of our Fiber Hooligans Facebook page and moderator of our Fiber Hooligans Ravelry group. For those of you who may have missed anything in this podcast, I invite you to join us in one of our groups. Tammy does such a great job of making sure we answer questions and provide links and follow up to anything you might have heard on the show. Next week, we will not be having a show. Again, I am moving, so we're taking a week off. But we'll be back the following week, where my guest will be designer, teacher, author, and illustrator Franklin Habit. Franklin is the author of It Itches, a stash of knitting cartoons by Interweave Press, and proprietor of The Panopticon, one of the most popular knitting blogs on the internet. On an average day, upwards of 2,500 readers worldwide drop in for a mix of essays, cartoons, and continuing adventures of Dolores the Sheep. Franklin's varied experience in the fiber arts world includes contributions of writing and designs to Vogue Knitting, Yarn Market News, Interweave Knits, Interweave Crochet, Piecework, Cast On, a podcast for knitters, Twist Collective, and a regular column for both Knitty.com and Lion Brand Yarns. Several of his independently published designs are available via Ravelry.com. He travels constantly to teach knitters at shops and guilds across the country and internationally. He has been a popular member of the faculties of such festivals as Vogue Knitting Live, Stitches, and the Madrona Fiber Arts Winter Retreat. Franklin is one of the most talented and one of the funniest guys I have ever met. He does a lot of work with us at the shows, and I'm very excited to have him back on Fiber Hooligan so you can all hear from him just before we all head out to Stitches East. I hope you'll join us for what I know will be an amazing show. I also want to make sure that you know that I'm eager to hear from you. You can email me questions, recommendations, critiques, and feedback at benjamin@fiberhooligan.com. And that includes suggestions for guests or cool things you'd like Tammy to talk about in her segment. If you want to email Tammy directly, you can do so at tammy@fiberhooligan.com. I don't promise to respond to every email or message, but I do promise to do my best to read them all. If you ask a really great question or have an inspired idea, I may even read your email on the podcast. If you're following us on iTunes, we have moved. You can find us now at fiberhooligan.com/iTunes. And since we're at a new channel up there on iTunes, I'd appreciate it if you'd leave a comment if you like the show. I'd like to thank Prime Publishing and AllFreeKnitting.com for their sponsorship of Fiber Hooligan. I'd also like to thank my editor, Christine Weir, as well as Simone, Caitlin, Chris, Keith, Stuart, and the rest of the gang at Prime Publishing for all their help. I'd like to thank my guests, Art and Barbara Elkins, for being so gracious with their time and being interviewed on the show today. And I'd like to congratulate Webb's America's Yarn Store on achieving the milestone of 40 years in business. I'd like to thank Tammy Burke for everything she does on and off the show. And of course, I'd like to thank all of you for listening. Well, that's our show, Fiber Hooligans. As we slide on out of here today, I'd like to wish you all a glorious week. Remember, the only thing better than being creative is being kind to each other. The good news, you can do both. Thank you for spending this time with us. We'll see you in 2 weeks for another edition of Fiber Hooligans.